Quarter past.
Yeah, taxis are on the
20th.
Oh,
okay. Because
you
find it's
exit
the premises.
Okay.
So there we go.
People are making their exits in various directions. But it's such a nice afternoon. I think if any, but before people go off for their trains, if they'd like to join any of us for a drink, we will just go back to Radcliffe. I think the bar will be open there, and that's probably the easiest place just to ease off and have a drink before we set off. We can arrange some group taxis from there to the station, because many are going to the station. If you'd rather go straight from here, then we'll get a taxi for you, but you'll have to tell us, you know, right at the end, and we'll try to get a taxi for you from here. So I think that's the main thing. We could all help Tim and Ellen to help clear up so that we can get to the bar quickly. And I think that's all. And I'm just going to introduce Chris Nierstratz, who's bringing us to the last part of our session called Statistics and Wider Impact. Chris was a little bit worried about using the word statistics, but we use this word in its wide 18th century meaning, which was much more than what we call statistics today. So I will leave it over to him to explain. Okay.
Well, welcome to the third session. The title is Statistics and Wider Impact. So it's not only about statistics, but also about the wider impact. And when we talk about statistics and wider impact, we're basically talking about the trade of, between Europe and Asia. And at its end, you have Asia on one end, you have Asia on the other end, you have Europe. And the way to look at that conceptually, you have to do something in Europe, send it over, and do something in Asia. So there's two contexts where actually the trade is happening. We've seen a little bit on that already in the networks and the market and sales. There's a lot happening in Europe where trade would go off, but I think, as Hugh Bowen has shown in his database, there's also a lot of things coming from Europe to Asia. And on the other side, there's also Asia, where there is a world existing where Europeans try to get hold of those goods and sent them over to Europe. The questions that we're going to ask in this session are related to those two things. So, first of all, is it time for a major revision of the to-date estimated volumes of trade in Asian consumer goods to Europe? So we all know there's been a lot of work on that trade between Europe and Asia. There's been the Dutch Asiatic Shipping book by Brian and Gasta, who first met all the voyages of the Dutch East India Company between Europe and Asia and back over two centuries. And they brought out a book called Ship Sailors and Spices, where they tried to bring that to a bigger dimension. And that's actually quite in the way that we want to see our project. We don't want to look at the Dutch, the English per se, but we want to bring that to a comparative perspective, and want to see if with that comparative perspective we can reach new conclusions about that trade. So we want to take a step back from the national way of organizing these things. The second point is, and here we come to the role that the state played in this whole process. What was the role of the state in different national contexts, for instance, for taxation and the success of the respective companies? So as Gerrit Knaap has already said, there's a very strong state element. We're moving towards colonization. In Europe, there's also a policy of mercantilism functioning at that time that I think we've already discussed a little bit, but maybe we can talk a little bit more about that here. In Asia, there's also there were always national differences between how trade was actually organized. You have the Dutch company, which is seen to be a monopolist, so they monopolize the inter-Asian trade, while the English choose for more freedom in their trade by allowing it to private traders, although recently that has come under discussion, and it's not very clear if the Dutch had a monopoly, but it seems that they, Europeans, they organize their trade in a certain way in Asia to suit what they can bring to Europe. So it's definitely something we have to talk about. Ah, I'm doing it again. Sorry. Last question. What are the links to material culture, history of science, and political economy? So there you see the, those bigger questions of the trade and then how it fans out into Europe and into Asia and cultural and political context of that time. Now, there's been some talk in already about ordering lists, and actually the rest of my presentation is going to give you a little glimpse of what we've been doing so far. So it's a preliminary result of the research that we have done, both in the archive in London, the British Library, and in The Hague in Holland. So it's a comparison between the English and the Dutch. And it's on ordering lists. So briefly, what is an ordering list? An ordering list is what the companies order in Asia, what they actually want to have. Now, as Cynthia has already pointed out, sometimes, actually most of the people say, they dismiss this list and say, this is what they wanted, but what they got is always different for whatever reason, be it that it falls off the ship or that companies servants steal it. But there seems to be a big, big difference to what people ask and what they get. Still, if you look at those lists, there's a lot of information there, even about, about Europe and about Asia, actually. So if you look at this one, this is Guras from Bengal. And this is the ordering list. And the way that we did it for the English, we did samples. So we took 70, 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50, and just tried to see how the demands of this particular textile have evolved. So you see that it's between 70, 10, and 70, 20, it's relatively low. And then suddenly there's a big jump in what they are asking. And you can see that there's an element of quality there, something that we've already been talking about. So there's guras that are super fine, very thick, finer, better sort. So there's quality there, and at the same time, there's measurements. So there should be certain amounts of guras that are, have a certain measurement, which is probably related to policy in Europe, what they would allow on the markets, or probably what people needed, the craftsmen needed as dimensions. So if you move to a comparison, I took another one here, which is Romals, which is also a type of cloth from Bengal. And there's different qualities involving silk and other kinds of fibers that make it into different quality sets. So if you see here, up to 1730, it's quite stable. And then there's a big increase towards the 1740s, which is mainly due actually to aromas of low prices. Those are really somehow the cottons that are in demand in this category. And then there's on top a little band of more specific and what look like higher quality romance. Now, if we then turn to the Dutch one, here I took, I did it a little bit more elaborately, but I only got to 1739. But here you see for every year, so this is not every 10 years, so it looks a little bit more, you can see the fluctuations a little bit more, so it's not that smooth as the other one, but it's more accurate. And what you see happening is, in the beginning, there's a large demand of around 6,000 pieces of romance. This is not comparable to what the English order in the later periods, which goes into the hundreds of thousands, but still, there's a demand for romance that the Dutch want to get their hold on, so they're demanding this. And here again, you see different qualities. It goes down, it goes up a little bit. There's a new quality that is demanded, but, well, they might have given up, or they couldn't get it, or the quality wasn't good enough. And then slowly you see the demand for romals going down. So around 1736, 1739, there's actually only the very, very, the romals of very high quality that's left that they want from Asia. So, and if you look at the English stat, it almost looks like they would fit into each other, like the English stat goes up, and the Dutch one goes down, although this is a little bit longer, so the cutoff point would be here. And what's even more strange is that at the moment that the Dutch give up certain types of romals, you can see here on the right that this little thing between 1740 somehow starts coming up on the English charts, the romals soupies of the Dutch sort. So somehow, somewhere, there seems to be a correlation between these ordering lists, which seem not very accurate. Mm. But if you would look at that in a comparative perspective, you somehow see that suddenly these English start asking the Romas that disappear on the other chart. So I still have to continue the Dutch line, but it kind of clearly shows that there's a strong relationship between the markets that the Dutch and the English are catering for. And at the same time, this is actually in this time, doesn't only happen to the Dutch, it also happens to the French sorts. So somehow, just at the moment that it disappears from the Dutch lists, it appears on the English lists. So with such a comparison, you can, of something that seems quite non-accurate, you can already show how these different kinds of cloth changed over time and how competition went. Something you will not get from the other sources, the sales lists, which are often much more put together. So you can just find the Romans, or you will just find certain types. So this is a way to get to what kind of qualities they send and what kind of qualities they wanted. So I thought I would throw that into the group, and maybe other people will have things to add of databases that they have that they think statistically can paint a similar picture. For instance, I know that Hugh's been working on his database, Postman's MP60, which is mostly on the imports. And I also know that Gerrit is working on his database for Asia. So I give the floor to other people.
Well, you can take the questions. I think Anjana.
Just a quick question on your demand lists for the Dutch. Mm-hmm. Are these the ones created in Amsterdam or in Batavia?
Well, they are created in Amsterdam, and then they're sent to Batavia, and then they're sent on to the
Coromandel and
Bengal. Exactly.
But do you know that the Amsterdam's list demand list is the same as what Batavia sends, or does Batavia change it? To suit, because Batavia feels that it has more information on the local markets. And
of
stuff,
course, there is there's always a difference between Batavia tries to cut up the order and send it to different regions.
Yeah.
And what you also get is that later on in the century, they start adding, for instance, they would add Roma's silk from this in this city, so the list gets more specific. So mm-hmm. they give more and more instructions to Batavia on where they want something to come from, and where they want it to be bought.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a development. It's very difficult to say what Batavia actually does with it, but it does seem that there is a relationship between what they ask and what they actually get. So
these are your demand lists created by the various chambers in the Netherlands?
Yeah.
And not part of the OBP collection, which would have come from Batavia, because I understand the huge archive that we have in the Netherlands is the OBP.
Well, the Dutch company also tries to function as an intra-Asian system,
mm-hmm.
and that means that it might be that Roemals are needed somewhere in the East Indonesian archipelago. Mm-hmm. So this is Bengal?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what they send to, what they demand, what Batavia demands from Bengal, is not only including the Patria demand, but also the, well, let's say the Asian or the Indies demand.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
I think that's probably the way that it functions. Because they also want that for their inter-Asian trade, they will add what they think, and then when it comes back, they probably will have to make a decision. Do we send it to Europe, or do we send it to the inter-Asian trade? So they also have to make a calculation of where the probability lies.
So these numbers you've picked up from the archives of the chambers of the VOC created in Amsterdam, not from the OBP. You understand the difference in my question?
Yeah.
Because OBP would be then demands, but still created in Batavia.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know about the Dutch East India Company, not much archives are left of the various chambers. You have only Zeeland to complete, but not the others. So,
well, the problem is the various Dutch East India Company archive is that the bookkeeping of the Dutch business is more or less left.
Mm.
So we don't know how it went with the auctions. We have a few lists of people who have bought something for a few years,
mm-hmm.
but that's only names and numbers, but how it really works within those genres is hard to say. That's why we have not so much to say about. I think it's from the company archive, it's difficult to say something about distribution of Asian produce once it comes in the Netherlands. And as we also do not have a good customs administration for the Dutch Republic, we have the same handicap.
I am just going to ask a question. I want to know what a Rommel Sooty of the Dutch sort looks like.
I would like to know what the Rommel Lungi is, because Rommel and Lungi are two very different things in my head. So it's the first time I see a combination. Georgia would know more.
Yeah, it's a strange combination. About silk in this case. Yes.
Yeah.
So what does it mean? I mean, what sort of, what does it describe it to?
It's difficult to say, probably, but we had a paper from the curator of the French Museum in Orléans, if you remember, in which their point is to try to match the names with these textiles. In that case, in order to acquire the textile for the museum, and it's really very difficult.
So, I think one of the things that might be quite useful is if we have any, to look at some of those pattern books there's a few of them about. I mean, are there any of those patterns that we could match up with any of these orders, just to have some idea what we're, what we're looking at?
My idea is about those patterns books. So far as I've seen for the Dutch case, there are hardly any left anyway. Is that the lists of types of cloth and the varieties is much longer than you find examples in the pattern books.
Yes, well, that's right. But you'd at least have some of them to match up.
There are some, but there are about 400 to 450 different varieties. Rommel is one with all those sub-varieties within it. So you can imagine they're talking about thousands. And that makes me wonder about the statistical value of this, compared to the overall figure. Here you're talking about such small percentages of the total trade that I wonder how much we can rely on these very, very small percentages in terms of the overall shift. I mean, probably your project would be to try to get all of these varieties and try to do all of these, but...
This is just a preliminary, this is just something I came across. I have no idea where it's going, or I just think it's interesting. So I'm going to pursue it, I think, because I when I saw that, what I see here, this is just one of the things I pulled out. And when I started looking at it, I saw that at the moment it stopped with the Dutch, it appears in the English. And I also have to say that the number that appears in the English list is quite close to the thing that's not there anymore with the Dutch. So even if you're talking about those definitions, what falls under what, apparently they knew what they were talking about, but of course it's very problematic to see the long-term implications of this, because it's living, and it's like you say, you're parceling up something that people have looked at it as a big chunk of cotton, and how can you relate that story to other stories? I don't know yet, but like I said, I think the coincidence is so big that this suddenly appears, that this must mean something.
Did you check whether it also worked with the French?
Well, I haven't gotten the order list of the French.
The Seance list in Wellington, I thought.
Yeah, but I don't really believe those statistics, so I wouldn't go by that one.
But that
would
probably also drop, because the Lyon factories are starting to produce their own list. So it's important. So I don't think that comparison wouldn't work. We have to stay on England.
Yeah, and for now that's enough work anyway, I think. But if somebody would do the French ordering list, find them and do them, that would be great, of course. You could easily add that, and that would make it even more dynamic. Did they stop asking for them? Maybe the French continued. their demand for these textiles, and we just lost them to the English. I don't know. I don't even know what the conclusion from this statistic is. It could be that they gave up, could be that they were outcompeted. Maybe there is a different trading strategy there. Of course, it can go different ways.
In that case, I mean, you need prices.
Yeah.
It would be very important to see the prices change. If there is really a shift in demand on the side of the company, you might see some volatility of prices in the moment of the shift, I would say.
Yeah.
You're taking over, Maxine. It took me a little bit of time. Micah, you have a question.
We can maybe just open the discussion a bit of what people think are valuable topics where we can actually draw very rich conclusions if we put this, the existing statistics together. I'm thinking a bit about, connecting it to markets, for example. Thinking about them, if you want to explain if there was something in the 18th century, for example, if the Hamburg market or in the German lands, a market for things, what could you use for all the companies in order to understand who provided for this market, and if they were all engaged in that on a small percentage, or if there was something like first the Danish, then the Swedish, somebody taking over. And I was wondering whether there is a way of getting different sources from different companies, just focus on one locality. This would be just one suggestion. I mean, there are thousands of.
Well, let's combine those two questions of Giorgio and Mike. And maybe ask, are there sources about prices? I think maybe that you can talk about your project here, and you can talk about his database.
Yeah. Well, in my institute, we have a Dutch Asiatic shipping database. It is something like the mother of all Dutch East India databases. And we have that since about 10 years on the internet. But it is actually statistical data taken from a book of Bruin and Gaastra on the shipping relations between the Netherlands and several parts of Asia. Because this is actually a project which was from the pre-computer period. You have only information on what ships are departing from where at what time. That's several tens of thousands. And as far as it comes to how many people there were on board and what was the cargo, there's only an information of there were 100 men, or the invoice was 100,000 guilders. And that is, it's not that there was not more, but in the pre-computer time period, you couldn't do that. Anyway, we're planning now to do something else, and partly it has been done, as far as the lack of the people on board was concerned. From 2002 onwards, we had a VOC opvarenden project, which is opvarenden, the men on board, and it's on names. So we have for the entire 18th century, we have all the people who left the Netherlands, whether they were German or Scots or whatever, entered in a database, and there are about 900,000 entries in it. So that's why. As far as the cargoes are concerned, of course, with better database structures, we are capable of doing that. And therefore, we have started in my institute a project called the Bookkeeper General Batavia, especially for the commodity. Cargoes. The whole administration of the VOC in the Netherlands is lost, but for the Asian Empire, which was centralized in Batavia, we still have the books for the 18th century, at least for most of the 18th century. So there you see the cargo from every ship coming into Batavia or in Colombo or whatever, specified how much bottles of wine you had and how much that cost, how much weaponry there's on board, how much European textiles there are on board, and on the other way you have how many rumals you have, how many pepper you have, all those things they are entered with and ascribed to value. And ascribed to value is not the real cost price, I would say, and not certainly not the selling price. So we are adding that now for the 18th century for all the ships coming from and going to the Netherlands. But the Batavia bookkeeper general also had a registration of the trade between Bengal and Batavia and the trade between Japan and Batavia and all those things. So you have in the bookkeeping you have entries for all those offices or factories, and there again you see so many rumals have been shipped by that and that ship, and they were costing cost price that and that. So that's a project we are working on, and I hope we can finish it next year. There are plans to do something of the same for the 17th century. We don't have the Batavia books any longer, but from several sources we can reconstruct the intra-Asian trade. Also add the, well, not only the movement of the shipping, but also the movement of the cargoes. So we are hopeful that we can also fill in part of the 17th century. And I think it would be nice if we could combine that with other companies in a way, if it's possible, of course, because of the sources. So that's, I think, what I have to tell about it for the moment. I cannot present you anything of conclusions because actually Chris says it's my project. Well, I initiated it, but I'm not doing the research for myself or the data entries at the moment. So we have to still wait until it's finished and then we can draw much more conclusions.
Does anybody want to react to that? Any other similar things?
Well, there's obviously the British case. I don't really like talking about statistics on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, but you know, I'll just sketch out what I did and what the potential is to do more, because there's a lot of data collection that I did that lies under what is available on the internet now, and I think marrying that data with other data sets does offer some possibilities, although there are limitations. I'm very concerned that there was no robust statistical data for British trade with Asia after 1760 at all, nothing whatsoever. And the reason for that is that the British customs records until 1834 used a generic descriptor, East Indies. So anything that went to India or China was described as going to the East Indies. So therefore it was impossible to disaggregate and find out what was going to Bengal, Bombay, Madras, or coming back. So using the company records, what I was able to do, or what I did do, was collect from the commerce journals every cargo manifest out and back, because they were copied into this master journal. Put them into a database, which allowed me then to aggregate on an annual basis for each destination or port of origin. Now, the complicated factor is that some ships obviously call with more than one port, so that there are three consignments sometimes to one vessel. So what I've got as my core data is a listing of each ship, each commodity, and each port of destination, and the commodity classifications remain the same virtually throughout, because these companies were nothing if not consistent. And what you then do is aggregate, and that generated the numbers that I've got in the data set. The problem lies with the import data, because the commodity descriptions there were under as I vaguely recall now, under three main headings: tea, drugs and chinaware, and textiles, and that was all. So that's a pretty blunt tool. But when you drill down into the cargo manifest, what you then find for imported textiles are these incredibly long lists of descriptors, which often, from Bengal, for example, there would be up to 100 in any 1 year. And clearly, I couldn't do that for the whole period. So what I've done with that is sample on a 10-yearly basis that, so as to get an overall picture of what is changing. There are methodological problems with spellings, for example, words that can't be easily distinguished, all that usual sort of stuff. But what it does allow me to do is calculate for those years the number of cloths coming in under and being delivered on each descriptor. And it's on the basis of looking at that that I made that observation earlier, that what one sees very clearly over the 60-year period are core classifications of cloth that remain constant, and then these other ones that they're clearly experimenting with. I've done nothing with two elements of this data. I've done nothing with the individual ship voyage data. Life's been too short so far, and I parked that one for retirement, I think. But I think it would be quite a useful research tool, because it would allow researchers to do two things. They could either search on a particular ship or a particular destination for a year or whatever, drag stuff out and manipulate it. And I've done nothing with the textile data, but I've got a load of it. And I'm more than happy to share that with anybody who might want it. There's an awful lot of it. But herein lies the problem. That relates only to the official exports and imports of the East India Company on its own account. What my other work has done, drawing on our discussion of networks earlier, is identify 9 other channels through which commodities can flow outward or back. So the big question is, what is the aggregate figure for those 9 other channels, and how do we begin to get a real sense of the volume and the value of that trade? Because, of course, much of it was illegal and not captured anywhere, unless you happen to come across private records and so on. I won't bore you with all the methodological issues, but there are very large numbers of ships that clear out of the port of London, declaring that they're going to Ostend or wherever, and then pitch up in Calcutta. There are the consignments of British commodities that are shipped out to Asia on board French company vessels, or the Danish private vessels. I've been working on that recently. And there's a lot of it. But it's masked in the record because, of course, it's British commodities under Danish flags. And the beauty of your project, of course, is that you don't really need to worry about the national aspect of this that I'm interested in, because you're looking to pull all of this material together. So I would say, yes, there's a big scope for bringing some of these core data sets together, provided everybody then understands that there's an awful lot that will still remain out of that. And the big story that I'm telling, just briefly to finish off, is that our characteristic view of British trade with Asia is that it's an unbalanced trade, that it's the value of the imports that far outstrip exports, and that's covered by the silver export. I don't buy into that at all, because what I've been discovering is, of course, this myth that East Indiamen sailed out half empty because they couldn't sell anything in Asia. It is just that, it is a myth. Because what was happening is that they were being filled with illicit or illegal commodities by smugglers and commanders and so on. And what I think is very interesting about what they're exporting really is the fact that it's all hardware, military equipment, guns, gunpowder in vast quantities, naval stores, and, if you like, technological items, I suppose. Things like cotton screws seem to be the flavour of the month in the 1790s. Large quantities of glass bottles, for some reason, in the 1800s, and so on. So there's a real sort of hard edge, I think, to the export trade to Asia that has really been overlooked because people have assumed that it's just to do with failed experiments in wool textiles. But there's a heck of a lot of metal, and in particular, of course, what I'm primarily interested in now is the copper trade and its exports of British copper to the Indian Ocean region that largely sweep away Japanese copper in the 1770s. So those are the sorts of things that you can begin to do with this, but I would welcome a pooling of all of this data because I certainly can't do much with all of it.
Just ask, what's the date range again?
1760 to 1833. But there is a problem after 1813 because you have an opening up of the trade to private traders, and it's difficult to get at that because you're back to the customs records then, and they still are just using this descriptor East Indies.
Is there anybody else who wants to add to that, or should we move to the...
I have a question.
These
ships going from Europe to Asia carrying technological items, was it the company traded in them, or was
both.
It was part of the company?
Both. The company exports a lot of stuff to sort of build up its military infrastructure, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So things like, I was looking last week at dock gates that were destined for Calcutta. There's
mm-hmm.
a very large consignment of that sort of material. But the complexity of this is that a lot of the illegal arms trade, and it is very, very high volume export we're talking about here, of course, is going to Indian powers.
Mm.
I mean, to people like Tipu Sultan, Hyder Ali.
Mm.
They're all purchasing their military hardware from European merchants.
Mm-hmm.
When Tipu's citadel is stormed in 1799 and they take an inventory of what they find in there, they're astonished to find that all of the artillery is produced in Britain and France and Holland. And they're appalled by this. Of course, it's the private trade that has actually fed all of this. But I think gun running in the early modern economy is something we really need to know a lot more about.
Well, I know from the Dutch East India Company that they actually sold guns, not the heaviest one, but they sold it to the private market.
Yeah.
I don't know the numbers, but... yeah, well, Europe to a certain extent was also arming Asia as it probably as it also did on the Gold Coast in Africa, and to supply slave trade in a way.
But this is a trend you sort of identify, well, obviously because you're covering the period 1760 onwards.
Yeah.
So exactly how empty or full the ships were before 1760, and I mean, my guess would be that we were less full. Or do you think, you know, what do you think about
that? No, I mean, people who are commenting on this in the 1760s, when there are inquiries into it, describe it as being an age-old trade.
Okay.
It's a branch of interloping.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is that they're using company vessels. Again, Andrew used that very good phrase, the company has an enabling mechanism.
Mm.
What the company does is enable an awful lot of private trade, some of which it licenses, the privileged trade, but an awful lot of which is then conducted illegally. And, you know, just to emphasise, I'm not talking about, you know, occasional chests of rifles or something. These operations see supply vessels going out to the Azores or to the Cape Verde Islands where transfers are then made. The evidence I've got of those are often of 200 or 300 tons of armaments, which are transshipped mid-ocean and then taken on. And the same thing's happening then on the way back. An example recently of that I think I covered of 3,000 ton chests of tea being run ashore. Off Falmouth, as it happens. and then the type of thing we were hearing about earlier in the Port of London. Another crucial pinch point for the company where all of their vessels leak phenomenal amounts of commodities because, of course, they're unloaded at Blackwall Reach and then all the commodities are taken up to the legal quays in Hoyes.
Mm.
Now, that's an absolute logistical nightmare, and an awful lot of this stuff just disappears. East India Company ships are described as fairs where people just swarm onto them and help, not help themselves, but with their accomplices, take an awful lot of stuff off.
English, you go first.
Yeah, well, Now we've been talking about the Dutch and the English. I mean, there are also at least attempts to get a total picture of who Europe-Asian trade. I guess the most recent is Jan de Vries attempt. And it gives you a kind of picture. The problem with, for instance, his work is that he's missing quite a large part of the Swedish trade, because she's using only Koenig's book and also a very large Portuguese trade. We haven't talked about Portuguese shipping because it's organized in different way, but it's very significant. The volume, the tonnage is going between Asia and Lisbon is actually really huge. These things must be, if you want to use that very general picture, so you have to always ask people who are working with specific specific companies or specific forms of trade to get a more complete picture. Specifically about the Swedish company and the available data on trade of the company and re-exports. On the one hand, we can say that we are talking about 132 voyages, which is nothing in comparison with English or Dutch. At the same time, Sweden has very good trade statistics, foreign trade statistics for basically both 17 or but basically for 18th century, so we have very good statistics, and a lot of this was actually published. So we have on foreign trade, so we have a lot of published statistics, and when you look at these published figures, so you see that these two ships annually could re-export volumes that are in early 80s close to the total Swedish exports of iron, naval stores and timber and everything. This is extreme period, about 1780s extreme period. It's a much smaller share, 20-25% during the whole period, but still it's enormous volume when you look at the export capacity of this state. Then we have also this data on re-exports, which I think are quite useful. Regarding the data from the company itself, it's much more patchy, and you had to go to a lot of different archives. As Hannah talked about, so we have a picture of sales from a specific ships. We have a picture of accounts of purchases of commodities for specific ships. But we haven't yet a complete picture of how the volumes and volumes of re-exports, imports, and purchase volumes were related to each other. So the best way to understand not least that kind of problems that Hugh is describing still is to go simply to private papers. And fortunately, there is a huge there are huge opportunities to do that. There is a lot of private papers in Sweden, in England, of course, also in United States, and not least in Belgium, that can be used and that create this. Make this picture more complete.
Thank you for comments. I had two questions over here.
I'm probably going to be back to bang on about a point I made at the very beginning, which is that one of the things that strikes me when I did any work which compared, and I would stress it's fairly limited, but when I looked at particularly aspects of the VOC's papers, the English companies, and even up to a point the Swedes, I would suggest that I make a plea for assuming that these companies don't just export goods. that yes, the large amounts of cloth, large amounts of hardware, I didn't realise it was quite that amount of hardware, but they are major exports of human capital, i.e. they are moving human beings in really very, very large numbers. That's what kind of struck me was, and if you think of statistical approaches, one of the things that strikes me is the way that the VOC audits its human capital is quite astonishing. They literally have list after list of where a person's from, when they joined, when they died, if they died. Same is true of the English one. One of the few times that we can genuinely begin to compare how these organisations traded is, yes, I suspect it would be difficult, but to do it in goods, it's probably easiest to do it in the human beings, because they keep such superb roles. But actually, the Dutch much sooner than even the Swedes on their individual ships will have lists in their logs. So one area where we can tie and understand that, I think particularly if you think of the companies as exporters of human capital, then you can actually probably do something where you can make a meaningful comparison. Because it's interesting that they're such multinational organisations in their personnel. The Dutch have so many Swedes, so many Norwegians, so many Germans. The English company have battalions of Swiss, in their, as did the French up to a point early on. And I think particularly there's common resonances. You can find parts of Europe that are not directly intersecting into the trade through high capital, the production of goods, but what they're doing is they're sending out human beings. And when they send out human beings, those human beings, the Asia trade acts as a transfer mechanism. You deploy human beings, and what you do is you get a kickback. The number of wills in the English presidencies where money is going back to Switzerland and to Prussia through military officers. In other words, there's a trade where human beings get out, die, or live for long enough, then die, but money's going back. And that is one area where I suspect there's huge potential to do a genuine comparison between the organisations, certainly the English and the Dutch. I suspect that probably the French too. Certainly from looking at Swedish records, although the Swedish one's much smaller, you would be able to do it reasonably well there too. And the number of human beings at any one time is small, but over the piste, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people just for that. That's before you get into the recruitment of a manpower in Asia, of course. But anyway, it's to say that trade could be in human beings, however bad that sounds.
But human capital is basically human capital in the sense of soldiers and sailors. If you look at the VOC's records, they have... Well, we have from 1691 until about 1790 of annual states of where everybody is. And there were almost 20,000 people on the list, so you can, it's huge. Mm-hmm. But the database about personnel is something else. We also have the accounts of people who were considered Europeans. And that's something else than those lists again. So it's tremendous what there all is. And it is quite, well, you have to make choices, of course, because it costs a lot. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But what do you mean, considered Europeans?
Yeah, well, in the Dutch muster rolls, you have sometimes you have the muster rolls for the Europeans, people who are supposed to come from Amsterdam or from the Netherlands to there, and they are written down in all those ledgers. Sometimes. Soldiers or lower personnel are recruited from Asia itself. Then they usually also are entered in the European list, but they are given a count in Chamber Amsterdam. That's one category. But you also have muster rolls for the natives, as they call it, but they are not always sent over. And sometimes you have individual names, sometimes you have that on the basis of a company. So if you have a company of sepoys from Malabar, they are usually put in those native muster rolls. So it's but the European muster rolls, they are preserved on a constant basis, and those native ones only sometimes. That's the difference.
we had a question over here.
Yes, I would like, given that we started off talking about statistics and also their failings due to smuggling, I wondered if anyone did anything with the French. Because to start with, there weren't very many statistics. There are some people trying to do things on, I mean, there's the teat rate and then Baudrillard did some statistics, but again, this was pre-computer age, so they are kind of hand-drawn and kind of, you know, deliberately, or I'm saying deliberately vague, but, you know, anyway, vague. But since then, you had the publication of Wellington, who did quite detailed statistics on sales records in terms of, especially fabrics, actually. So you get all these listings, and I just wonder if, it's one part of the question, if anybody has used that, and if anybody, that's the second one, has ever done kind of, you know, national comparisons in smuggling, because what strikes me is what, and I'm not an expert on French smuggling at all, from what I know about how it worked, it would have been quite different from the English model in that they would land in Lorient, so that wasn't as big a port as London. You didn't have that many different ships coming. And they would be met by an official representative from the state, an official representative from the company who would supervise the unpacking and would supervise the lading into the warehouses, and then would put two seals on, one kind of, well, that varied over time, right? But you got up to two seals because you had the smuggling later on. So you'd had a company seal and then, say, a state seal to say these are legal imports or these have to be re-exported. So the smuggling would be at a different place. There would be, for instance, in copying those seals and putting them on later. So it wouldn't necessarily be in getting things off the ship at Lorient out of the warehouses, or it would be before stopping in Lorient, all these kind of little ports down Brittany. In fact, apparently, when we went to Lorient, the big lighthouse there, they told us was built so that they could look over the little islands to see if the ship was just stopping for a couple of hours just outside Lorient to unload. So I wonder if there's any comparative smuggling anywhere. And I do wonder if anybody ever uses the French statistics, given that they're published in English.
I do use them.
Hooray. What did you do with them?
Well, I compiled overall numbers, first of all, to know how much we had in terms of textiles. Also, it is very difficult to say how much it is in percentage of the entire cargo in terms of French. It's much more complicated than the other companies. And they're also compiled in a very peculiar way by Wellington. The Brea crew has his own way of compiling them, they're slightly different. So.
There is a wider problem with all the smuggling statistics, that they're only built around those smugglers who are actually caught.
Yeah.
So you may have a set of statistics that show you so much tea is being smuggled.
There aren't any statistics of smuggling in France.
In 1780.
Not so low.
How much they got away with by virtue of not being.
Okay, I think we should also. You wanted to say something?
I just wondered if you wanted to intervene on Wellington's data, as you said you believe them.
Well, it's not that I don't believe them, but I agree with Giorgio that it's very hard to see what he actually did and how you can use them. And I don't know if they are complete. If I look at them, they just seem to be. He put them in an order that you can't understand and that you can't actually use it, so you would have to go back to the archives and check them again and see if they are totals or just it's just like with smuggling, is it just what he found but not the total number? He's not very clear on that.
Oh yeah, but it is, you list the sales catalogs they're taken from and sells you, so you know which sales they're represented, whether he added two sales for that year or whether there was only one sale that year. So it's fairly, I mean, he's very open about where he gets the stuff from, so in that sense I think they're reliable. As far as I can judge. I mean, he's very open about where he gets it from, so it's not in any way kind of, it's not made up, and he tells whether he calculates in weights or in pieces.
Well, we were in X and we looked at those those archival things that he got it from, I think.
No, we didn't.
No,
no,
okay. Well, but I wanted to
widen the discussion a little bit, because I think we're talking too much about statistics. Maybe we should move into mercantilism both in Asia and in Europe, and to see how politically this trade was organized. I think we already had a little bit of a step into that subject by you when you said that, well, there's all these different ways of organizing trade and different strands coming in. Maybe other people have ideas about that too, or maybe about the way politics were organized in the different countries.
This is actually ignoring you completely. Sorry. going back to the earlier conversations about hardware being taken out of England and their provinces. In the 1620s and 30s, there is a number of evidence talking about the East Indian Company in England actually investing things in things like gunpowder mills and a foundry. And these are relatively large proto-industrial sort of projects. And I was just wondering if NDU takes it to the end of the 17th and into the 18th, when there's a continuation of East India Company investment within the UK when it comes to producing things like that.
Certainly in terms of the production of muskets and then rifles, they operate with a very closed group of suppliers who have to produce their weapons to what are known as India patterns. It's a very good example of the way in which technology is adapted to a particular circumstance. And that becomes, I think, quite a well-worn sort of supply mechanism. I'm not so sure about gunpowder, but of course the corollary of that is that much of gunpowder produced in Britain uses imported saltpeter. So it's an interesting saltpeter coming in and gunpowder going back out. But I'm not sure whether there's a direct process of exchange, as it were, or whatever. But that needs a lot more exploration, I think. The whole business about how the military infrastructure is dependent on things produced specifically in Britain in that early period, because our knowledge of this tends to start in the 1680s, I think.
Mm-hmm. There is some work done by a man called Fuller, I think it is, on what they were producing in Sussex for sale.
Yeah, that's right.
And there are a couple of books on the Dutch side.
I think the Dutch tried to put up a gunpowder factory in Chinsula. It functioned for a decade or so.
They had several gunpowder factories all over Asia.
Yeah.
But from the 1620s, I don't know. But later on, there were about six or seven.
The Chinsula stops. They stopped functioning within 10 years.
Batavia and Ambon and so on, other places also, they have gunpowder factories over there.
I'm not quite sure how complex it is to make gunpowder, but if they're building these across Asia, do they have to take the actual parts that make a gunpowder mill from Asia to Asia?
Yes.
From?
I cannot tell you.
And one of the themes that's emerging here, looking at the bigger picture, really is the extent to which, right across the piece, these monopolies are complete fictions, aren't they? Everybody is finding a way around them, through them, over them, in them, utilising them. They clearly are useful in terms of providing an organising principle for a range of private actors. They provide the infrastructure, the support, the protection. But other than that, these are monopolies that are not regulated or policed very effectively. There's a lot of connivance with private practice going on throughout, and so on. And they really are all, I suppose, coalitions of private interests, which are, to a lesser or greater degree, allied with national interest.
In a way, yes, that's what we all find. But if that is true, why then is it such a big debate in France, which is the one I'm quite interested in, about the abolition of the monopoly in the late 60s, which really involves kind of the highest government circles and the biggest shots in the Republic of Letters. And it's a massive debate in the 80s again, when they then set up another monopoly company. And that plays a role in the French Revolution, even when they abolish it in 89. So there seems to have been something about monopoly that I mean, it might just have been public opinion. It might just have been the perception that there is a monopoly and therefore it is something that is part of the old economy and you have to get rid of it because monopolies are stifling free trade within France, so they must do outside. But the fact that this could excite so much interest that you could have a pamphlet war about it, there must have been something about these monopolies that...
Well, they're clearly critical in supporting state apparatus, aren't they? They're important funding mechanisms because they raise huge amounts of customs duties that are useful for the development of fiscal military states of all sorts. They are seen to be a cash cow, despite their inefficiencies. They are the sort of mechanisms that states need, and in a competitive world, I suppose there's an element of sort of almost prestige in terms of actually possessing one, so that you have a state with its ancillary operation in Asia. It's quite a bold state that would actually wave goodbye to all of that and sort of let it go.
Yeah. At the same time, because of that, they become objects of both envy and suspicion on the part of those people who aren't involved in the market.
Maybe this is a good moment to get the word to one of the smaller company people, because I think he has something to say about mercantilism.
Exactly. I think there is a lot of more theoretical stuff on what chartered companies are. But all, just to my knowledge, all this is written basically from the English and Dutch perspective, which, monopoly companies, perhaps unfunctional, but definitely monopoly, and as you stress, so they were very important from a fiscal point of view, from the British state. But then you have this a number of small companies that are officially chartered companies, but their business is not at all dependent on monopoly sales in Sweden or in Denmark or in Prussia. They are depending on quite different, they are depending on re-exports and maybe making business there. And these small companies are not at all important from a kind of fiscal point of view. So they must be seen with different eyes. They must be seen as something different. But at the same time, they are not just a kind of partnerships or merchant networks, because they are using flag of the state when it's fitting and so on. So I think we have to make clearly differences between the, that kind of companies, between big companies and small companies, because they are functioning in a very different ways. The precondition for activity of small companies actually is mercantilism of big companies, monopoly of big companies. So it's a very strange symbiotic relationship. But
the Dutch company was actually maybe not so much a milk cow for the Dutch state, but for the old elite in the Netherlands. So the discussions and the pamphlet wars about it in the 1780s were basically about those people who were not part of that elite establishment and those who were not, which happened to be, the opposite party was the Enlightened Party. But I think the milk cow for the Dutch early modern state was the re-export of Asian products, not so much the import, because that was for the Gentlemen 17 and all those urban elites. But it's interesting to see what happens after the company is dissolved. In 1795, the Netherlands becomes a satellite of France, and then the British take almost all the colonies, and formally the company, the Dutch East India Company, is going bankrupt. It's nationalized by the state, and although the trade is dried up totally, the state still holds to that monopoly. They continue with that. And when you see in 1816, when
let's say about 2/3 of the Dutch colonies are restored by the English. So after the Peace of Vienna and the London Convention, mm-hmm. you see again that all those things, the regulations for coffee, for the spices, they are still in the place. So in principle, the people, they are delivering to the civil servant. And the civil servant, although it's then the Dutch East Indies government, the Indonesian people still say the company. So there's a continuation going on. And of course, the strange thing is that those people who are protesting against the monopoly in the 1780s, they are in charge in the period after the Netherlands has become a satellite state of the French. So it's always opportunistic, I think, in a way, how they deal with monopolies.
Just a short comment on this question of pamphlets. There was quite a large number of pamphlets published also in Sweden criticizing the Swedish East India Company. But basically, I would say that opinion was not negative. When we look at the other parts of Swedish mercantilist policy, which was really shaping the economy of the state with trade and iron production and so on, there the debate was much harsher and also result of the mercantilist policy, and the criticism simply was much, much bigger. So the chartered company, Swedish East India as a chartered company, was not a political issue.
I mean, I was just totting up in my head all the sort of various companies that there are, and what strikes me is that in a sense the EI, the English East India Company, and the VOC really are exceptional, and I don't mean so much in terms of their scale and their presence in Asia. Because if you think about it, okay, they are in basically continuous existence from the early 17th right through until either the late 18th or early 19th, if we accept the loss of the monopoly for the English in 1813. But if you look at all the other countries, if you've got France that tries various incarnations in the later 17th, it's kind of dropped, reformed. The Danish one's something similar, although my knowledge of the Danish Asiatic and the base is similar. Swedish emerges in the 1740s, the Scots try one in the 1690s, it fails. Ostend, ditto. In other words, in a sense, you could learn as much about how mercantilism works and doesn't work by, again, looking at the failure of organisations or simply a state's decision at some point to give up on it. And it seems to me what's interesting is that big states with clear mercantilist policies like France, well, still, we can't even make it small country versus big country because France doesn't fit that model. But it is interesting that there's a period from roughly the 1660s to the 1730s when there is clearly an attempt to diversify the sort of models of companies that are available. And that sort of, in a sense, all fades away, bar the honourable exception of the Swedish one and the Danes up to a point. But it's also a period of failure of companies that comes earlier than the fading away of the big two. And it does suggest that mercantilism is itself capable of considerable state experimentation, that actually we shouldn't think of it as a big monolithic system, that actually they are experimenting with various outlets, it seems to me.
Yeah, I was just very curious to hear when you said there were Swedish pamphlets as well. What time do you have these pamphlets in Sweden?
For instance, the problem with silver export. The company was exporting silver, so problem with imports of silks and so on. So there is a number of issues that were criticized. But as I said, when you look at, there is a huge mercantilist debate in Sweden in 18th century with a lot of published things, not least in 50s and 60s, with quite big political struggles affecting mercantile elites in Stockholm. But this is not about Swedish East India Company. It's about other things.
Right. But it's quite interesting because, you know, you were talking about the debate which is in the 60s in France, mm-hmm. and then there's the dissolution of the East India Company. And in Denmark, it's in 72, and then that breakdown of the monopoly, and then you have the same. So there may be, again, this European debate where they're borrowing ideas from each other, but still there will be this national framework because obviously they're responding to political domestic issues as they were in France, where it was as much the struggle between the parliaments and Versailles, right? That, and they were using this company as a way of sort of forging these ideas about we are a republic of, you know, merchants, not, you know, and then, you know, against this despotism of the ministers of Versailles. So there's a national context, domestic context, but there probably also a wider context where they're sort of, you know, emulating each other's ideas.
If I can just very short comment, this big crisis for Swedish mercantilism was actually 1765-66.
That's
very interesting. Yeah, I wonder whether there's a general, general kind of crisis of the moral economy of the company, because even in England, I think for instance Burke and Clive must have been really crucial, and they, I think, and I'm not an expert in this, but you have similar moral arguments in Rénal in France. And I think there might, you know, it might be, you can very easily say it's the rise of the liberal economists versus the kind of mercantilists and rise of enlightenment, kind of, you know, and even the kind of the bureaucratic enlightenment and the trickle-down effect, but I wonder.
First Hannah and then George.
Yeah, a few things about the last discussion, tying in, there's also the Swedish silk industry in Stockholm that I think voices were raised in connection where the criticism was really sort of just expressed. Mm-hmm. But one thing about Andrew's comments about sort of successful and non-successful, I think the Swedish and the Danes were, when the Danes and the Asiatic Company and from the 1730s and onwards, I mean, where they really hit it off was in the China trade, where they all competing on very even basis when they shop in Canton. And I think that's really important in order to understand the success of that, those two operations. And I don't know, maybe one way to think about it is a little bit like the Danes and the Swedes. They were a little bit like the Ryanairs of the 18th century, utilizing the sort of infrastructure that KLM and British Airways and these big companies had brought up, and then just cut the price and budget operation, and off we go.
We've had Primark and now Ryanair. We're going down market slowly and surely. That's a good analogy.
In the case of France, of course, I mean, there was a very important shift in 1759 that concerned textiles, but it is the bulk of the company's trade, in which finally internal production of cotton textiles and other so-called Asian textiles, Asian imitation textiles, is allowed, although the trade of Indian and Chinese should be still forbidden according to the 1759, but in reality it is impossible to distinguish them, so they come in large quantities. That is, I think, very much a point in which you have a very strong force in terms of manufacturing interest against trading interests. It becomes very strong in the 1760s to simply stop trade altogether. And my analysis specifically of textiles in various different companies shows that there are moments of general debate, general mercantilist debate about the nature of the company, for instance in Britain in the 1790s, but then there are also intense debates that are very, very specific. So they might relate specific to silk, specific to cottons, yeah, and so on, in which essentially you say, this is an evil, but let's try to limit as much as possible. It's in the interest of the state, but you have other interests that says there are also our interests here at stake, and let's try to limit as much as possible the action of these companies. And then you have very precise interventions within the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm afraid we don't have much to say about the Danish Asiatic Company in this connection, but I during the discussion I've been wondering, what is the criteria for failure or success? If I may draw your attention to the Danish West India Company, the intention to create that company and establish a small colony, Danish colony in the Caribbean, was to pave the way for private enterprise, and the success of the Danes, West India and Guinea Company, the complete success was in 1754 when it was dissolved. Mm-hmm. And the private enterprise could take over. The colony was there, the shipping expertise and so on was created, and private enterprise could take over and make good profits.
Yeah.
And I think that when the Asiatic Company was created in 1732, their main field of interest was the China trade. And that was a monopoly, like the India trade was. But in 1772, the monopoly for India voyages and trade and shipping was dissolved again, and again, the way was paved for the private enterprise.
Okay, sorry, I'm just trying to write all these wonderful things down. Yeah. It's been such an interesting discussion. I really like, it's really fascinating to see all this these parallel, comparative discussions of mercantilism and the debate, the pamphlet wars, the debates over this. One of the things that I was really interested in discovering more about when I wrote the application for this project was to find out more about the improvement societies across Europe and what they thought of Asian and luxury goods and how they were going, the introduction of these kinds of goods and an introduction of Asian goods as well would fit into the framework of the development of their own national economies or their, in fact, their own responses to this wider trade in this wider international trade. I found there is a whole section on colonies and the commodity trade amongst these colonies in the Society of Arts, Manufactures and Arts, Commerce and Manufactures, now called the Royal Society of Arts. And I know, I mean, I am not an expert on all these interesting, very interesting Enlightenment societies, but there are a range of them across Europe. There's the Economische Tak in Harlem. I don't know anything about that. The L'Académie Royale des Marins in Marine in Brest, the L'Académie de Marseille, the L'Académie de Bordeaux. There's the Royal Danish Academy of Sciences and Letters, the Society for the Promotion of Fine Arts and Practical Science in Denmark, the Royal Norwegian Society for Sciences. Was there any debate, any discussion in these improvement societies of these, some of these, these mercantilist debates certainly, but also of the introduction of these kinds of commodities and that trade in these commodities in these areas? So I will just leave that open. It's this is not right now, but it is these, you know, the wider ground level discussion of the of these issues.
There has been work done on that in the French case. So when the recent kind of sway of books on the French political economy, so Chauvelin and Henry C. Clarke they have books on that, and they spend a lot of time actually looking at these academies. And what they find is that, what everybody finds is that they see a general development in France that there's a move towards luxury, and they think it's all right, and that's winning out. And then from the 60s onwards, you suddenly have a reversal of opinion. So they say that, for instance, Rousseau won because the provincial academies kind of agreed that this whole luxury thing wasn't going very well. And then there was this revival of agriculture, which is not only the kind of at the top end, the physiocrats, but it's at the very kind of low end, the academies kind of have competitions about, you know, how to improve, I don't know, ploughing and that kind of stuff. But it's a big focus in that shift from a pro-luxury argument to a pro-agriculture and revival of agricultural virtue. And I think in this whole argument they talk about the crisis that came with France's loss of military position after the War of Austrian Succession and the Seven Years' War. But I actually think that the French East India Company plays a huge role in that. I think that their loss of what they thought was a possibly a dominant position in India, and the fact that they felt they could possibly kind of, you know, the situation that Britain was in after the end of the Seven Years' War, the French thought they could be in. And I think that loss accounts for a lot. And I think that is the problem with looking at these improvement societies and all that. They have never, in the general kind of political economy, they don't do that in global context. So I do actually think that is really, really important in the case of France.
I was actually more thinking, I can just say what I was thinking then. The abolitionist society during the French Revolution is really borrowing all kinds of models and ideas from different experiments and societies that have been performed, for instance, in Asia. It's quite interesting to see how these forums also become forums where they discuss new ways of empire building, borrowing from these other empires and models and different economic models that they've used, and also discuss technology, for instance. That's where my brain was going with that.
In Sweden, right, the special twist, and it's against the backdrop of the 17th century and the sort of loss of the Baltic Empire, and then here it's very much trying to sort of recreate some of the luxury, if not production, at least harvesting in Sweden. So this emphasis on many attempts Linnaeus had, for example, to grow tea in Sweden. But there's also mulberry trees, silk production.
Yes.
And it's trying to reconstruct these sort of manufacturing processes. I think that is definitely very clear attempts.
Yes.
And then again, as in France, very strong. Well, you see the sort of physiocratic ideas coming in the late 18th century. But I don't think,
It's fascinating the way in which the debate over that can be tied to different countries, because the example of Scotland, there is a ferocious debate by the improvement for the Society for the Improvement of Knowledge, which is founded in the 1720s.
Yes.
And right through the 20s, 30s and 40s, it's basically saying, and it particularly focuses on French brandies, French silks and tea. And it basically says, and it's in the context of essentially the disillusionment in north of the border with the fact the Union hasn't yet delivered massive economic prosperity. And so in the context of continuing underdevelopment, what the earth is Scottish society doing, wasting its time with these commodities?
Yeah.
And there is the famous 44 petition where literally every borough in Scotland, from Lerwick, sends in a petition saying we're just going to stop drinking tea. If we have to stop drinking tea, if we're going to drink any tea, we'll drink British tea, but even that's probably a bit suspect. They gender it by saying it just turns everybody into women, first of all, which is interesting. But then that just rapidly fades away.
Yeah.
But if Martin Powell was here, he'd be able to say that if you then go to the 1770s and 1780s in Ireland, when Ditto was having a new constitutional problem, East India goods are hugely politicised.
Yeah.
And effectively there's a question as to whether you then consume them or not. There's the effectively Ireland is the equivalent of homespun, sort of, you know, they've taken the lesson from the American colonists and said, we're not going to touch this stuff.
No.
And in a sense, this is to come back to the idea of mercantilism and the state, the national context. One of the first things that's politicised is Asian goods. You can be straight away if there's a problem. They're going to start getting problems of them being critiqued in a general question of hostility.
That's the buy-off of the 1782 constitution in Dublin. Essentially, they get home rule for verifying that English, British India Company's monopoly in Ireland. That's essentially the play-off.
They can maintain a monopoly, but they give them a free constitution.
This is a good moment to bring this session to an end. Thank you very much for all your remarks, but I think we still have Maxime, who's going to wrap up everything.
I haven't prepared anything to wrap up, because that would have been kind of preempting things, but I have just learned an enormous amount today, and it's also just been great to have some key colleagues from various parts of various other parts of Europe, of Suriname, of India, to have, and Italy. I had forgotten Giorgio and
Italy.
Okay. So, we will. Yeah, but I just think, you know, it has been this chance for us to spend some time together. We're all so busy, and we just get sort of totally kind of tied up in our own institutions and our own, and somehow stuck in our own countries because of this. So for me, it's been just enormously valuable to have this chance to eat together, to talk together. And I have just loved this format that we have today. I don't know what other people think about this, but not having long papers, even half-hour papers, and not 15-minute papers that are really half-hour papers. scrunched into 15 minutes, which is what I experienced at a conference recently. So I just think there's been. We have been able to have, you know, very much a free-ranging discussion, but a free-ranging discussion that has been very well structured in the frameworks that were set out by our postdocs and PhD students who worked very hard together, a real collective effort in setting out the topics, the questions for each section today, and just gave us something to think about. I just think it really has shown what an enormous thing we've all taken on, that there's so much more to do, that I had felt when I, you know, again, when I set up this, was writing the application for this, that there had been so much work going on with a very different focus in the 1960s, 1970s, and then there was the imperial, you know, very much the empire work that carried on in some countries, such as the Netherlands and in Britain. But we kind of lost out on the Danes and the Swedes and the Prussians and the French. Yes, what happened to the French? Yes, the French just stopped writing about this. So we couldn't get Audrey to come here today, and trying to find someone else, it was just really impossible. So we have Pernilla, so who's been able to help us quite a lot. And so it's the Danes who work on the French, and the Germans who work on the French, etc. So we got to get the French to work on some of this. I just thought, you know, really, it's kind of this, the whole opportunity that I think these global frameworks and have offered have been to take us back to these wonderful records that are available in these European archives. We must go to archives where we can find them in Asia, where we can get into them. But there are lots of, we've just seen just the richness of the records that are here, and it's getting more of our historians to work on those and talk amongst each other, and to go to all those wonderful collections across Europe's museums, and museums in India and China. There are wonderful collections in the Chinese museums and some of the Indian museums, but there's quite a lot of museum development that needs to become the next thing on the agenda in India.
Yes.
So I just think this, you know, I just sort of feel it's been the moment, and I think our discussions of today have really shown just how much we can learn from each other, work together, and take this into new areas of discussion that we haven't been looking at in that way before. I think there are also a lot of areas that, we discussed so many areas today, but there's one of those areas that I'm interested in, and we didn't really have any discussion of this today, And it's all those.
Come back tomorrow.
Yeah. We had a lot of discussion about trade and goods and commodities and all those things. But actually, learning about production, learning about consumption, that's part of that whole area of useful knowledge, which some of the people at the LSE are dealing with. But I think we also have to tie it to the very important role played by the companies, but also private traders and merchants connected in this, that so many of these people had a great interest in collecting the knowledge of India, collecting the knowledge of China, and of Southeast Asia, these areas where they were trading and working in. And so we have to also look to those archives and connect up that discussion of trade and the commodities with the, you know, the really crucial thing that really has always interested in me is how was it made? How do we innovate? How do we change things? And that's part of that whole initiative, I think, behind so many of the botanical and industrial travelers that we find playing also a very, very strong part in the in that whole edifice created by this East Indies trade in the period. And I think I'll just stop there because others may have a few things they want to offer on this issue. And it's also an opportunity for people, I'd like people to have to also provide some of their responses to, what we've been discussing today, where we can take things forward, further connections that we can have. So I just do want to thank everybody for coming together to have this discussion, for the team that put all this together. They, you know, it was the postdocs and our PhD students who really wanted to do this. They pushed me, say, we need this workshop, bringing these experts together on the companies. But in particular, I do want to thank Tim Davis and Ellen Filer for all the practicalities, all the correspondence, and doing the stuff that makes a workshop work. Okay, so I'll just stop there. Any other comments from people?
Everyone's pooped.
It's a wonderful closing comment.
Do you all want to see each other again? I mean,
if not, then at the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich, there's an exhibition going on called Traders Unpacked. It's about the East India Company. So if we don't want to see each other tomorrow, you should go there.
John McAleer's it's his gallery.
It is
the gallery that he's created.
Be very modest.
So everybody go to the Traders Gallery and buy the Monsoon Traders.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you
invite
it, why don't you all invite us all over?
Yes, all come down. It's all free for entry. So yeah, I can't even get you free entry, but it is free entry. It's a permanent exhibition. I think it's the first. So it's not going anywhere quickly. Be more sense than one. But.
I thought for 1 second that the whole thing was going to end in an exhortation to buy.
That's very appropriate.
That's not
it?
Bad, actually.
The marketeers would have won eventually.
Well, I think the next move is that we've got 5 minutes, 3 minutes before I think you're making your exit. Why don't we have a quick gathering on that wall and we can take a photograph and then you can go.
You're about to go.
Everybody against the wall for a photograph.
And then
we'll go for a drink.
I can't get up to the office tomorrow morning.
Very good.
It's a nice sending company. I always think.
Yeah.
I think we all have to move together more. Just a couple forward.
You have to squeeze in.
Yes.
Yeah. Only the kind of
little bit.
Squeeze in. Very close. Come on, Hugh, you'll have to come in behind.
Yes.
We don't have one of those fancy cameras.
He's in your cheese.
Which one?
And I'm trying now with another
girl. Okay.
Smile.
So, okay.
Smile.
Stand up. Stand up. You have to push hard.
Yeah. No, it's taking pictures. Wonderful.
Okay. It doesn't have a flash. There was no flash, but I don't know if you want a flash.
Yeah.
No
flash.
Okay. There.
Ik ben daar geboren en getogen.
Oh ja.
Ik ben daar geboren en getogen.